Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins. I work for Fairway Markets in the New York area, and we're awfully proud to support Heritage Radio, and we care so much about everything that goes on out here at Roberta's in their studio, because they talk to people who are serious about food, and that's what we are at Fairway, is we're serious about food. We just care very deeply about you as a customer, and how you cook and what you cook with and how you entertain, and that's why we love to support Heritage Radio, because it's pretty much the same thing. It's wanting to find happiness through serious food and people who are serious about it and care about learning everything there is to learn about it. And that's we're kindred spirits. If it's something worth having in your kitchen, you're going to find it at Fairway. And if there's somebody worth talking to about food, you're going to find them on Heritage Radio, and we will be supporting you guys for a long, long time. At Fairway, I'm your personal grocer, Steve Jenkins, Fairway Market.
Boys, I'm mellow as a honeydew. Yeah.
That cat is high. Look that look in his eye. Oh man, he's high. Yes, higher than a kite.
Hi, you're listening to The Speakeasy on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Damon Bolte, and my guest today is Thomas Waugh, currently the head bartender at Death & Company, a very famous cocktail bar in New York City, and formerly of San Francisco. Hello, Thomas. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Damon. How you doing?
I'm doing well. How are
you? Thanks for having me.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about how you got to the point where you are now, being the head bartender at one of the world's premier cocktail bars, and basically how you got to be in New York City and working where you are now.
Yeah, well, I mean, I get asked this question a lot, and it's a lot of people ask if we go to a bartending school to get to where we are, and you know, but I didn't go to any bartending school. In fact, I didn't go to school at all. After I graduated from high school, I knew what I didn't want to do, and that was go to college. I just wasn't ready, and I wanted to travel a little bit, live in different places. But, you know, ultimately I had to find a job to support myself, and you start in the service industry. I mean, it's the easiest job. It's the most lucrative job. And yeah. I started in coffee shops and sort of worked my way up to busing in restaurants, serving in restaurants. And then, you know, eventually, once I finally moved to San Francisco when I was about 22 years old, I got into the bar business through one of my older brother's friends. Got me in as a bar backing job at actually a nightclub, a huge nightclub.
Yeah, so. It's funny that you started out as a barista. We were talking about this a little bit earlier today. And then you started out doing that. Then you went through like...
I'd call myself a barista. But back then, I probably called myself a barista. You know, that's pretty... Probably had a lot of pride, but...
Right. It's the whole coffee scene nowadays is very intense. There's lots of techniques that are coming up that have never been seen before. You know, people are starting to use more like Chemexes and not just the traditional French press and espresso shots. But I think it's interesting that you started out that way because, I mean, obviously you're behind the A bar working with drinks, you know, and then eventually you wisened up and started pouring alcohol instead of caffeine.
drinking things that matter. No. I mean, I love tea. I'm passionate about tea, coffee. I love wine. When I go out, you know, with my girlfriend, we go eat at restaurants, and I totally dork out on food and wine just as much as I dork out on any other, you know, just as much as I dork out on cocktails.
Cool. Yeah. Well, the food scene in San Francisco they're very serious about it out there. I know that you get a lot more local produce and stuff like that than we probably get out here, you know, obviously being in New York City. So they tend to take that to kind of another level that we're probably not able to get to.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'm sort of a country boy at heart anyway. I grew up in, you know, in the mountains in Northern California. So that whole organic thing is sort of important to me. It's sort of embedded in me, I think, you know. And definitely after moving to New York and eating out here, you know, I mean, New York definitely has a food scene that rivals San Francisco's for sure, but it's just different, you know, and right. It definitely food and local produce and just local thinking locally and ideas as far as organic things, you know, definitely trickles down from the food scene in San Francisco to the cocktail scene. And I think that is what makes a big difference between the New York scene of cocktails and the San Francisco scene of cocktails. I'm not saying that it's better. I would say that the produce is better for sure. It's fresher. It's better. It's just a source that in California. You just can't. It cannot be rivaled in New York.
You know, I mean,
I know you're probably hating me for saying that. Everyone that lives in New York right now.
Yeah. No, it's
true.
No, not at all, man. But that brings up an interesting point about like the difference of West Coast and East Coast cocktails. I mean, West Coast. I obviously being the entire West Coast, I'm really trying to say West Coast versus New York City cocktails. And that the West Coast, even including, you know, like Las Vegas and parts of Arizona that have some cocktail bars going on now, it tends to be a lot more herb driven, a lot more produce going into the cocktails. Whereas here, you know, we don't really have access, and it's definitely gotten better with like a lot of rooftop gardening and like biodynamic farming and all this stuff, but it seems to be that like the New York or East Coast, whatever you want to call it, style of cocktails, when you say it's more like dark and stirred and like more bittered and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, well, sure, in a way. I mean, Phil Ward, the how I got out here basically was through a program that Phil Ward had put together, who was the original head bartender, bar manager, and opener of Death & Company. And he wanted to see different bartenders come through and see what different people from around, you know, the world had to offer, you know, and with their different styles and whatnot. But he definitely taught me one really important, valuable thing for my whole idea about making drinks is that you can find flavors on your back bar that you didn't really know existed by blending things, you know, and that's the art of mixing drinks. You know, instead of using Coca-Cola, I bet you there's a way that you could mix a drink that tasted like Coca-Cola.
Carpano Antica and Fernet Branca.
I like where your head's at.
That's actually that's a really good point, and I would like to talk actually about that program for a second, if you don't mind. So I didn't realize that Phil Ward was the one that put that together. I know he was like the original head bartender of a Death & Company. Remember he and a few others that kind of like left Pegu Club when started up as the initial staff there. As far as like. I'm just fascinated by this program because you're getting a bunch of bartenders together that don't necessarily maybe get to travel a lot and hang out with other bartenders from around the world. You're getting them together and you're riffing off each other. You're exchanging like kind of your secrets, techniques, recipes, ingredients that are regional. Not just fruits and vegetables and herbs and things like that, but also like if you go to Chicago and you go to the Violet Hour and they have you know, the Chicago has Jepsen's Malort. You can't get that anywhere else in the world
for a reason
because it's kind of disgusting, but they really love it there, you know. And it's one of those regional things that was passed on to, now it's been passed on to other bartenders and I guess our community, that, you know, it's good to know about. You definitely want to know about it. And like information is really important with what we're doing.
I definitely have to tip my cap to Phil for inviting me to come work his shifts behind Death & Company for a week when I was still living in San Francisco. And I mean, in turn, he covered my shifts at the Alembic Bar in San Francisco.
Right.
Because that's a pretty ballsy move, you know.
That's a lot of trust
for a head bartender to leave his own bar and let some punk kid like myself come out, you know, and probably screw everything up. But no, I mean, It's true. There's you're probably saying, you know, there's in a way in this industry there's a lot of rivalry, a little bit of competition, mostly hopefully friendly competition.
Right.
But at the same time, there, you know, we are a certain breed of people that sort of know how to connect and come together when it's important, you know.
Yeah,
comes to growing and, you know, learning new things and stuff.
Absolutely. Speaking of competitions, you've been in quite a few competitions. You've won quite a few competitions. When I talk to some of my guests at my bar about, you know, cocktail competitions and when these spirits companies put these on, and they always seem to be kind of like blown away by that. They don't know that side of what we do. And there's a lot of incentive involved for bartenders to actually be creative. So, I mean, I don't know if you wanted to talk about any of the like trips you've been on because of these competitions and how you got involved with them in the first place.
Yeah. Okay. So when I was still barbacking at the Starlight Room in San Francisco, which is a beautiful hotel bar. A little bit cheesy, I won't lie, but most hotel bars these days are.
That's true.
To be honest. But at the top of the Sir Francis Drake Hotel in downtown Union Square in San Francisco, I was really lucky. I was able to work with some of the best bartenders I know, to be honest. One of which, you know, Marco Dionysus, who still to this day, like, I look up to him so much. He taught me never to be ashamed of your profession. And at that time, you know, I was a very, very new bartender, very interested in, you know, bartending, but still a barback, you know. But I have to really tip my cap to him for, you know, sort of supporting the idea that being a bartender is not a crime, you know, and that it's not just some segue to make money while you're, you know, learning to be going to school to be a lawyer or a doctor or something, you know.
Right.
Geez, I'm losing my train of thought now. What was the
original? We're gonna start talking about competitions.
Oh yeah. So Marco and Jacques Bezaden, who were both on the board for the USBG, which is the United States Bartenders Guild, and they convinced me to join. And at the time, it was $100 a year to join. And I thought, I don't know if I want to spend $100 on that. But they convinced me to do it, and I did it. And I entered my very first competition, which was for Hennessy Cognac. And I thought, well, anyway, it'd be a good experience. Out of the blue, I won. And then later that day, the regional competition went on. So there's a local competition and then a regional competition, and I won the national competition, which basically sent me to the world cocktail competition in Helsinki, Finland.
Awesome.
And I mean, that just terrified me, basically. I was way over my head, you know. I made a drink it was basically a sidecar with Benedictine and Mandarin Napoleon and orange bitters. Cool. But yeah, I mean, definitely competitions. I think, you know, one thing, you know, Brian Miller says, you know, is that it's only good for one person. It's only good for the person that wins, really.
Yeah.
And for the most part, bartenders aren't really good at losing, you know, and nobody wants to be a loser.
It's funny you bring up Brian Miller and competition. He was my guest last week, and he was talking about exactly what you were talking about not being ashamed of your position, and about, we also hit on the subject of bartenders being bartenders as a profession and not just like something you do while you're going to school.
Or being a bartender. I mean, Marco, who I was talking about earlier, he still bartends at like three different places in San Francisco. He's probably had more bar jobs than anybody in America. I mean, literally, I would say he's probably worked behind 40 different bars at least. But, you know, he's still just bartending, and he's not. And I know, you know, one day your bones are going to get old, you're old, and your hands aren't going to be as coordinated as they used to be, and you're probably going to need to look somewhere else. But, I mean, a lot of really young, talented bartenders right now are turning to other jobs, like consulting jobs, which is nothing wrong with that, good money, and, you know, using your profession in a good way. And, you know, becoming like liquor reps and stuff. And I think, man, well, why do you got to go and do that? Like, when we really need you as a community, as a great bartender behind a bar, you know, serving people.
That's really interesting. You know, there was an article in the New York Times about, I want to say like 6 or 7 months ago, about bartenders turning brand ambassadors. And it just makes sense for them to do that. But one of the points that was made in that article is that you're taking these men and women that are these amazing bartenders, like well-pressed, amazing mixologists, if you want to use that term, which is almost a no-no these days. It's just loosely it's used too loosely. But taking these really great bartenders from behind the bar and putting them out there, and then when you go to the bar, you know, you've got maybe not as good of a person back there making drinks for you. But the thing is about that I mean, people that are doing this kind of bartending and like the work that hard at it deserve to eventually get a cush job that they can like hang out and talk enthusiastically about all the stuff that they know.
I'll tell you one thing. When I first moved to New York City, I was working at Death & Company and I had one shift. And I was sort of looking around at other bars to work at, and Clover Club was definitely one of them. And I think, you know, quite honestly, Julie Reiner was a little skeptical. She kind of knew I had moved here to work for Death & Company and, you know, maybe didn't want to hire me right off the bat because she thought maybe I was going to, as soon as I got my shifts at Death & Company, I'd just be out the door, which actually kind of happened. But I did need to find another job to make money. Everybody needs to make money. Right. And I did take a consulting job with Bold Geneva. It was a brand rep job with Bold Geneva. And you think that you go off and get away from the bar and start talking to people and start sort of selling liquor, you know, to other people and getting people excited about a certain product would maybe make you feel like your life's a little bit more in order and that you wouldn't be drinking as much and that, you know, it's a little bit more of a daytime job. And
not true.
I'll tell you what, it was rough. I didn't want to drink. I didn't want to drink anymore.
Yeah.
I was getting to the point where I'm like, this isn't even fun. And it's nothing against the Bold Geneva. I think it's a great product, and everybody I worked for was nothing but good to me. And but after 2 months of schlepping around town trying to sell a gin, I'm using
quotation. You can't see here. It, but there's quotations.
It was much more difficult than I thought it would be, and I had to quit. But so there are people that are really good at doing that job, but there are also people that are really good at being behind a bar.
Right. Hey, you know what? We're going to take a quick break right now. You're listening to The Speakeasy on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Damon Bolte. My guest right now is Thomas Wall. We'll take a quick break, and we'll be right back, and we're going to talk more about anything that involves alcohol and Thomas Wall. Whip doesn't crack anymore. The lions, they won't bite, and the tigers won't roar. All right. We're back. My guest today is Thomas Waugh, head bartender of Death & Company in New York City. We are talking about his experiences coming into New York City from San Francisco and talking about being a brand rep for a little while and being a bartender. And we just took a shot of Fernet Branca.
And can you smell it?
Can you smell it? You probably can. This microphone's going to smell like awesomeness for the next couple weeks. You know, speaking of Fernet Branca, it's a huge thing in San Francisco. And it's actually, I believe, still, but not for long, the largest market for sales of Fernet Branca. The first, of course, being Argentina, where they drink it with Coca-Cola, Fernet con Coca. And then San Francisco, second, being shot. You know, like mostly shot based, and then chased with ginger ale, if I'm correct.
Yep.
And
Or not even.
I mean, I prefer chasing it with a beer.
That's what
I'm talking about. You actually have a couple of... you've got some Fernet-involved cocktails. You've got... I remember the first time that I went to visit you, we were just talking about Clover Club and Carroll Gardens in Brooklyn and working for Julie Reiner. I remember the first time that I met you was actually at that bar, and you... I asked you for something, a cocktail involving Fernet Branca, and you were like, oh, that's funny. I just moved here from San Francisco. I've got this one called the Frisco Club. And can you tell us a little bit about that guy?
Yeah. Basically, the Frisco Club. All right. Well, first I'll say I have to tip my hat to Pegu Club, not only the bar, but the cocktail.
The cocktail.
It's probably one of my favorite gin sours. So basically, which, you know, okay, so the Pegu Club, you have orange and Angostura bitters, fresh lime juice, triple sec, Cointreau, Curacao, whatever you will. I prefer Cointreau. I know that that's not exactly perfectly correct, but that's just what I like. And then a London dry style gin. Well, basically, the Frisco Club was a variation on that. With dry gin, grapefruit juice, Salerno blood orange liqueur as the, you know, the orange element.
Right.
And then fresh lime juice and Fernet Branca substituting as the bitter instead of, you know, the orange and ango. But, I mean, that drink was, I think it was one of the first drinks I put on Death & Company's menu when Phil was still the head bartender and sort of ruling the place. I'm pretty sure there's plenty of San Franciscans that are bummed out that I named a drink called the Frisco. nobody from San Francisco calls San Francisco Frisco. But
that's funny.
What are you gonna do?
Yeah, it's kind of. I'm also referencing another article. There was one in Tasting Table that I was a part of, probably about 8 months ago, that involved Fernet. It was about Fernet Branca and cocktails that used Fernet Branca, and it was talking about how. How Fernet Branca taking in shots is kind of like the bartender's handshake. You know, like anytime you go to any place like the Randolph or like, you know, any bar
where... What do you mean by that, Damon? A place like the Randolph?
Well, I mean, places where bartenders hang out and...
Sure. I'll accept
that. Like after hours. There tends to be a lot of Fernet Branca shots and... that just reminded me of something else. I'll get to in a second. But it's kind of crazy. It's like it's such an acquired taste for anyone that's ever had that. They know that.
I think the first time you take a shot of Fernet Branca, you know whether you're gonna love it or not. You might not enjoy it the very first time, but there's something invigorating about it. There's something that almost kind of punishes you in a way that you like.
Yeah, exactly.
So if you like pain a little bit, you know, you're probably going to like Fernet.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, when I was living in San Francisco and, you know, coming up as a bartender, I had a lot of people, older people above me that, you know, got me way into Fernet and stuff. And at the Starlight Room where I started, they had to take Fernet out of the program. Because it was just getting drunk too much by the bartenders.
And
it couldn't be stopped. But it couldn't. That didn't stop us from coming in with a 375 of Fernet and hiding it, you know, at the bottom of the ice well.
Yeah.
So
I feel like it's the cocktail bartender equivalent of like the dive bartender shot being Jameson. I remember working at a couple of bars back before I got into the cocktail bars, working there and just going through so much Jameson, like disgusting amounts of Jameson, and now it's switched to Fernet Branca. It's like when you go from ordering like one bottle a month to, you know, five cases a week, it's pretty ridiculous.
Yeah, well, I just hired a new bartender from San Francisco, Lane Ford, at Death & Company, and I'm finding myself ordering a lot more Fernet than I was, you know, before. I drank so much Fernet in San Francisco, and I had a friend of mine who came to me one day. I said, all right, we're going to do a shot of Fernet one night. And he goes, man, I cannot do a shot of Fernet. And I'm like, what are you talking about? What is wrong with you? And he's like, no, the last time I drank so much Fernet, I had the worst hangover I've ever had. I felt like I was going to die. And I'm like, give me a break. You're being a total, you know what? And I go, and then it wasn't, but like about a week later, I had a night where I drank so many shots of Fernet, and I woke up and I knew exactly what he was talking about. It was probably the worst hangover I've ever had. Too much of a good thing equals a really, really bad thing.
I've found myself in those situations before.
I didn't drink Fernet for probably at least 6 months, I'd say. I didn't even want to go near it. And I know that sounds kind of lame. You always hear people from their college, you know, experiences saying, oh, I can't drink tequila, you know, I'll barf all over you. But that's kind of the way I felt a little bit.
Yeah.
And then I slowly got back into it by after, you know, a huge meal, a steak dinner or something, something very heavy,
right.
Too much food, food coma, the only thing,
it's
no other
intended
Amaro.
Intended use, yeah.
No other Amaro can, like, rival
the
digestive qualities that Fernet has.
You know, it's funny because they claim that if you... Yeah, like some of their earliest claims when it was invented in 1845 were that it was a cure for like menstrual cramps and hangovers and all this stuff. And
yeah, it does all that too.
you've had luck with your menstrual cramps being cured by
my menstrual cramps when they start flaming up, you know.
It's funny too because like I'd heard I know by. Now is the fact that like they say that if you just drink Fernet Branco all night that you'll wake up like feeling like $1 million and no hangover. But I've tried doing that and you don't just drink Fernet Branco all night. It's always something that you're drinking along with something else, I feel like. You know?
Sure.
I mean, I would like to see if we could actually do that one of these nights.
Well, how many nights do you actually stick to one single thing all night long?
It's true.
How many cocktails can you actually drink in a night?
Right.
I don't know. I mean, I know how many cocktails some people can drink. I've served them that many cocktails, but for me personally, I can drink maybe two or three max. Actually, I'm like three or four max before I just want a beer and something neat, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
And then some crack.
You mean, yeah. Yeah, that's pretty good too.
Just as a nightcap.
Just as a nightcap. Oh, man. Okay, actually, you were wanting to make a drink on the show today.
Yeah, I do.
And it was funny because earlier when we were talking about this and planning out the show, we were talking about glassware that we needed and the possibility of like bringing ice into the studio. And Thomas told me that we did not require any ice for this cocktail, which really piqued my interest. So why don't you take it away?
Okay, so we're going to do one of my favorite and oldest, historically one of the oldest cocktails. It's actually not technically a cocktail, but let's just call it a mixed drink.
Yeah.
But it originated in in the old Dutch bars and the old Geneva bars where men, mostly men, would sit and have a beer, usually something stout, malty, big beer, and a little cold shot of Geneva, which is essentially like people put it in the gin. They put it in a gin category or a certain category of gin, but it's really not. It's more of
like a whiskey.
It's more like an unaged whiskey that's very lightly flavored with botanicals. Unfortunately, I don't have any Geneva with me today, but the next best thing I have is a very, very light Irish whiskey, the Napogue 1994. But basically what we're going to do is a Boilermaker. That's right, ladies and gentlemen, a Boilermaker.
Nice.
No, it's... I'm just going to take my flask here and...
Thanks for letting us hear that.
Yeah, there you go.
The opening of the flask.
Poor Damon.
Thanks.
Poor Damon a little shot. Some nice light Irish, malty Irish whiskey. I'm going to take our stout that we have here. You can drop it in, but I think I'm just
going to pour
mine in.
Yeah.
As well.
Yeah, I always thought it was down the hatch, man.
Cheers, my friend. Thanks for having me.
Oh, my goodness. That is good. Yeah, the thing about the dropping the shot glass into the beer, it's kind of unsanitary. You've got your hands on it. The bartender has their hands on it, but I just want to say that most times, bartender's hands are pretty clean because you're constantly washing your shakers and mixing glasses. But
never scratching your butt.
And never scratching your butt.
You don't want to do that.
You don't want to do that behind the bar. Mm-mm. I mean, you do, but you shouldn't.
Yeah.
But also, it's as it's sitting on the bar, you know, you could pick up some debris or whatever. Anyway.
I just don't drop it in because you probably end up breaking all your glassware.
That's true, too.
here I go, thinking like a bar manager again.
Yeah, exactly. Costing of glassware skyrocketing.
I actually once had a bar back who, when he got tired of washing glassware, he would just throw glasses in the trash.
I finally caught him once.
I'm like, what the fuck is going on? Why are all our glassware, why is it disappearing? Yep.
I admittedly was working at a bar one time every time we would take a shot, I would throw it against the wall because I thought it was funny. I thought it was old saloony, you know, kind of that had that vibe going. But and then when I started managing that bar, I quickly stopped doing that. Thomas, I really appreciate you coming on the show, and I appreciate you making a Boilermaker for us. And let's have you back sometime, man.
I'd love to. Thank you. All right, cool. Fun.
Thomas Waugh from Death & Company has been my guest tonight. You're listening to The Speakeasy on the Heritage Radio Network every Wednesday at 3 o'clock. I'm your host, Damon Bolte. Thanks for listening. Cheers.
Good night. That cat is high. Look at that looking in his eye.